Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight, where Tony Maher makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute in our relocated office, which has a bit of a background in industrial relations. If you see the note out the front, it was an early meeting here of the 19th century of industrial relations practitioners. Now, our speaker, Tony Maher, was educated at the University of New South Wales. He worked as a miner and then joined the Federated Engine Drivers and Firemen's Union. Following an amalgamation, he became general president of the Mining and Energy Division of the Construction, Forestry, Mining, Maritime Energy Union, CFMMEU. And Mr. Maher is going to speak for us tonight on the topic of energy, mining and climate, fact and fiction. Tony Maher, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared. Thanks for the invitation. Good evening, everyone. A couple of weeks ago, climate protesters were getting arrested outside the International Mining and Resources Conference in Melbourne. You might remember that. Inside, attendees were listening to scintillating presentations, like an update on plant and processing at the Fosterville site, how we've achieved high-grade qualities and how new plant will meet future processing requirements. Then there was highlighting the benefits of quality haul roads. Now, in our current political circumstances, one doesn't have to look far for examples of just how messed up the politics of climate and energy has become. But for me, when an essentially boring industry conference becomes a hotspot for angry activists, it's a sign of just how far our public discourse has strayed from reality. How basic facts and information are getting lost in hyper-partisan conflict. Perhaps instead of carting protesters down the road to the police station, an appropriate punishment might have been to make them sit through a session or two on increasing mineral processing performance through integrated mine and port operations and material tracking. After all, an engineer with a PowerPoint presentation is enough to strike fear into anyone's heart. And you never know, the protesters might have learnt a thing or two about the industry they're trying to shut down. Now, as the leader of a union representing Australian coal miners and power workers, the climate change challenge has been on my radar for a very long time, unfortunately. There is so much at stake for all of our members, for families, for communities, in getting climate policy right. So it's beyond disheartening to witness the destruction of good policy and the degradation of the debate over the past decade. In the absence of a coherent and economy-wide energy and climate strategy, we have instead entrenched climate wars, where coal is actually the only villain, and many participants have reflexive rather than rational positions. On the right, there is outright climate denialism, or at least the view that Australia has no need to play a role in reducing emissions, quote, because we are a small country. On the other side are those who believe that to avoid climate Armageddon, Australia must lead the world by reaching net zero emissions first. Not also, first. Now, those of us who accept the science of climate change, support well-paid blue-collar jobs, and are seeking a way forward that reduces emissions across the economy and leaves nobody behind, have had no help from those at either extremity. Sometimes these two extremes even join in temporary unholy alliances. We saw it 10 years ago in 2009 when the Greens joined up with the Liberals and Nationals to sink Kevin Rudd's climate pollution reduction scheme. Arguably, and there are arguments about it, the best scheme ever developed for Australia, which covered about 70% of the economy, but which made allowances for energy-intensive trade-exposed industries and for high methane coal mines, among others. I know, I participated in those negotiations. The Greens opposed it because it was allegedly too weak, and the LNP simply because the hard right had just knocked off Malcolm Turnbull over this very issue. Now, a decade later, in the recent federal election, it seems to me we saw something similar. The Australian Greens and many Green NGOs chose to focus on shutting down the export coal industry, with stopping Adani as the symbolic prize. So instead of focusing on the more pedestrian but essential task of reducing our emissions here at home, it's a basic fact that under the international architecture of the Paris Agreement and other climate instruments, responsibility for emissions lies with the country in which the emissions occur. And this isn't any kind of cop-out or buck-passing. It's the principle at the centre of the only international agreement in town, one that took 30 years to negotiate. But it is a fact which is that being at best ignored and at worst completely misrepresented by the Greens' anti-export coal strategy. That strategy reached its absurd culmination with Bob Brown's vainglorious convoy into central Queensland, deeply traumatising and polarising hundreds of thousands of voters along the way. The campaign against the export coal industry and the anti-Adani convoy in particular was like manna from heaven for the LNP and for those even further to the right. The voters of central Queensland and the Hunter Valley were herded into the arms of One Nation and Clive Palmer, from where their votes via preferences went to the LNP. For the federal government, the campaign against export coal has been the gift that keeps on giving. They have countered the fantasy that Australia must shut down its export coal industry with their own fiction that there are no challenges ahead for our coal industry, and that fighting greenies is more important than the hard yards of developing sensible industry policy. The outcome of the anti-export campaign was not only a failure to stop Adani, which was always a strange objective because it really is just another coal mine, but to contribute to an election outcome that sets back climate policy in Australia. My main purpose here today is to talk about the facts of Australia's coal industry and how those facts should inform a response. Don't worry, I'm not an engineer and I don't have a PowerPoint. Apologies to engineers, they're lovely people. But I do believe that for an industry that is so important to our economy and increasingly so important to our politics, we are overdue for some myth-busting. The first point is that the export coal sector and the domestic coal power sector are two very different beasts. They need to be understood and treated differently. The domestic electricity supply industry accounts for about a third of Australia's total greenhouse gas emissions. Virtually every owner and operator of coal power is today saying that they will ultimately close and not replace their coal power plants. They've told the stock exchange that. Apparently you have to tell the truth to those people. Now, we do have mavericks like Trevison Baker, who joined Australia's rich list after the New South Wales government sold him a power station for $1 million that is now worth several hundred million. And we do have Resources Minister Matt Canavan pushing new coal power for the town of Collinsville in Queensland. But it's pretty clear that any such plant would require both a capital grant from government and indemnification from carbon costs for the life of the plant. In other words, they would need to be subsidised or protected from the market. So even if a bit of new coal power comes to pass, it doesn't change the trajectory of the industry. The market has spoken. Coal power plants have been closing for almost a decade now, and they will be progressively retired and not replaced over the next couple of decades. The main debate about them is how soon they will close. Will they live out their 50-year lifespans? They generally have a 50-year lifespan. Or be forced out earlier by the amount of renewables coming online? Or will they be forced out by artificial deadlines? Some green groups are calling for the phase-out of coal-fired power in Australia in 2030. And that's just a recipe for blackouts. Now, coal power today is still an essential industry. It's got 21 power stations that still supply 60% of our total energy needs. Those power stations are in several key regions, the Latrobe Valley in Victoria, the Central Coast, Hunter Valley and Lithgow areas of New South Wales, to the west of Brisbane, near Rockhampton and Gladstone in Queensland, and around Collie in WA. In those regions, the power stations and coal mines that supply them tend to be the foundation of the economy. Our calculations are that there are about 8,000 direct jobs in the domestic coal power industry. A good chunk of those 8,000 workers are members of our union. If we add in the indirect jobs, say another 10 to 11,000, and then double it to include dependents, we have 35,000 people who are dependent on coal power alone for their livelihood or well-being. But let me contrast those numbers with the broader coal mining industry, which is overwhelmingly for export. The size and significance of the export coal industry are widely misunderstood. There are those who try to downplay the significance of the coal industry to the Australian economy in terms of employment numbers and economic value, as if its loss would be no big deal. They are wrong. They are very wrong. Coal mining is a major provider of well-paid jobs in regional areas and a big earner for the whole economy. It is our second biggest export earner. Australia produces 450 million tonnes of black coal annually. That's about, picture this, 3 B-double trucks for every person in the country. Right? About 40% of that is coking coal, nearly all of which is exported at a value of $38 billion. Global demand for steel is not shrinking, and there is no replacement for coking coal in steel making, not for a long time anyway. So this coal has a long future. The rest is thermal coal for power generation, three quarters of which is exported. That's worth another $22 billion. That $60 billion in export earnings we get from coal makes it second only to iron ore as our biggest export industry. And our coal exports are growing. The main scenario of the International Energy Agency in their World Energy Outlook is for Australian export coal volumes to keep growing for another couple of decades, even as coal production and use shrinks in many countries, and indeed even as coal use here shrinks. There are around 50,000 direct jobs in coal mining. If we take a very low multiplier of 1.3, that's another 65,000 jobs in the industries and public sector bodies servicing mining communities. Add in some dependents and it's easy to see over a quarter of a million Australians depending on the coal export industry. Coal for export employs six times as many people as the domestic coal power industry and is one of the export industries on which Australia relies to pay our way in the world. Do you remember when China sent a few boats away from China and back to Australia? The Australian dollar dropped overnight. What other industries have that impact on your economy? Its loss would be seriously damaging to the Australian economy. We shouldn't underestimate the extent to which our economy is not prepared for an end to export coal. Yet it was the export coal industry that green groups have chosen to target, not to reduce emissions in Australia, but to reduce emissions in those countries that buy and burn our coal for steel or energy. Customers for Australian coal are mostly in Asia, including India, Japan, China and South Korea. Now, under the Paris Agreement, those countries are responsible for accounting for the emissions that they produce when they burn it to make steel or energy. They are responsible for reducing emissions according to their own national commitments. In the current debate over Scope 3 emissions, that's those emissions produced by the end user of the coal, organisations like the Australia Institute are making disingenuous and misleading claims about the emissions produced by Australian coal. The fact is that everyone's Scope 3 emissions are somebody else's Scope 2 and Scope 1 emissions. Under Paris, those Scope 1 and Scope 2 emitters, whether it's a power station in South Korea or a steel manufacturer in China, must manage and account for those emissions. If the deal was that nations were responsible for emissions generated in other nations, there would be no deal. There would be no deal. It's not a matter of just tweaking the deal to get that outcome. There will never be a deal like that. Attacking our export coal industry has always been a project that, even if it succeeded on its own terms, would fail in reducing global emissions. That is, there is not a skerrick of evidence that Japan or China or any other market for Australian coal looks to Australia for direction in their energy policy. Those countries are making decisions about their energy future in line with their own commitments under global agreements. But they will not do so simply because Australia refuses to export to them. If one source dries up, they will turn to another. There are plenty of sources of thermal coal, Indonesia, Colombia, South Africa, Russia, and even the United States if the price is right. It's called a market. Coking coal is a scarcer commodity, but Canada and the USA have always been willing suppliers. So we come now to the uncomfortable truth. There is not a single example of any other country choosing to restrain their energy or other exports in order to reduce emissions in other countries. It's a cross that has been invented for Australia to bear. So there's a final kicker from the anti-export coal campaign. The campaigners all dutifully add just transition to their campaign demands. That box ticked, they can maintain their rage to shut down the industry as soon as possible. But there was no substance to the just transition claim. Coal miners generally earn more than $100,000 a year, and those smart enough to join the union, closer to $150,000 a year. Got to do a bit of self-promotion. For working 12 and a half hour shifts underground or in open cuts, they deserve every dollar they get. But you can also see why the jobs are so valuable to the communities. Now, those saying they want just transition for coal miners tend to skip on the pay issue, thinking coal miners should get new jobs that pay a third or a half of what they're currently earning. Especially when they say coal miners should get jobs in renewable construction. Sorry, but the word has got around that a lot of jobs in renewables pay lousy rates of pay. And if builders can get backpackers to do it for even less, they'll do it. Now, that doesn't sound like just transition to move. And not only do coal miners see activists trying to shut down an export industry that is currently large and growing, but as an added insult, what they see on offer is a traditional structural adjustment where workers get cast on the scrap heap. Talk about lose-lose. So if Australia is to salvage a way out of the current climate wars, we need to focus on reducing our own emissions across the whole economy, meeting our own Paris targets, and managing the decline in the domestic coal power sector that is already underway. The focus on shutting down the export coal industry has not only been unsuccessful on its own terms, it's also been a counterproductive distraction from these important tasks we're failing at. Planning for a just transition as domestic coal power declines is important at a number of levels. Obviously, because the workers and regional communities that have literally powered Australia for decades deserve it. Also because we need to carefully manage the impacts on other industries and workers that rely heavily on reliable baseload supply that coal power delivers, like aluminium and energy-intensive manufacturing, and that's a story that needs to be told much more. And because it's the best starting point to rebuild some political and community consensus around Australia's energy future. Now, the federal ALP took a policy for a just transition authority for power station sector to the last election. Its goals were to coordinate closures, manage workforce decline through job transfers between power stations, and manage regional investment in coal power regions. Employers in the industry would have been required to give lengthy periods of notice, participate in a program of offering voluntary redundancies in their operations, keeping in mind that redundancies are often desirable for much older workers, and offering those jobs to workers from closing power stations who wish to remain in the industry. Now, the power industry operators didn't complain about that policy. I think they might have had, and still do have, bigger fish to fry. The possible divestment orders for so-called energy misconduct progressing through Parliament this year are far more of a threat to the industry than the costs of redeploying some workers. But whatever it's called, an independent authority established by government to coordinate closures when they are inevitable and to support energy workers into new jobs remains sound policy. In fact, I would argue it's essential. As is investment in regional economic diversification, which is the bigger ticket item in achieving just transition. Examples of successful just transition are hard to come by. Now, the Victorian government is investing in the Latrobe Valley to help develop an alternative future there. But they are doing what should have been done over decades in a hurry because of the sudden closure of Hazelwood, hence the importance of long periods of notice. Now, many people are rightly looking to Germany as the gold standard. In Germany earlier this year, a deal was done among the national government, certain regional governments, industry, trade union and even green groups. They must have some more sensible ones than us. They bargained over the closure of brown coal mines and all coal-fired power stations by 2038. All right, 20 years. This builds on their phase-out of black coal mining for economic rather than environmental reasons. They were subsidising it for, I think, 3 billion euros a year. They were doing that for economic reasons. But they were doing it over 30 years to 2018. Now, the fact that Germany has reached consensus on phasing out coal is not a lesson in how or why Australia should phase out our large and growing export coal industry. Germany's black coal industry was uneconomic and in decline. But it does offer a roadmap for our declining domestic coal power industry. There are 2 key aspects to the German program that have made it a success. The first is the strong tradition of social dialogue, where governments discuss things with industry and unions and seek consensus. Remember that? The second key aspect of the German program is that no one gets left behind. They look squarely at the coal-dependent regions and at the coal power workers, and the decision is that everybody gets a future, a good future. When black coal got phased out in Germany, there was not one single forced redundancy. There were 130,000 people. Everyone retired or moved to a new job that was found for them. In the new program to 2038, there is again a commitment to no forced redundancies and a diversification program in the coal regions. Tens of billions of dollars, I think it's 40 billion euro, will be spent, but it's a small part of the total cost of rebuilding the energy system. Just a couple of weeks ago, Catherine Tenner, head of Energy Australia, said that Australia would need about $400 billion in investment to reduce power sector emissions to zero. So a small fraction of that to look after the workforce and the regions that are now dependent on coal power is a reasonable investment to protect against whole communities sliding into poverty, dysfunction and political alienation. Creating a positive local example of just transition is an important step to reassuring affected communities. Now, I draw attention here to what AGL has done with the Liddell Power Station in New South Wales. They actually gave the workforce 7 years' notice of closure, and even better, have promised no forced redundancies. The current workforce will be retired, offered voluntary redundancy, redeployed to the nearby Bayswater Power Station, or redeployed to new activities on the same site. Now, this commitment by AGL is given scant attention. It's as if it didn't exist, even though it's emerging as a benchmark for just transition. Now, investors also have a role in just transition. There's plenty of action around coal divestment. You read about it every day. Around investing in renewables. But how much attention are they paying to ensuring that good jobs are not lost and that the new jobs are good jobs and that the coal power regions get a new future? And the green groups, I'm sorry to say, just need to butt out. They need to stop defining just transition for us, stop provoking and antagonising coal communities, and accept that Australia has a big enough job reducing our own emissions rather than taking on the role of managing the emissions of other nations. All they are doing is feeding a cynical view in the coal regions that they, the Greenies, don't understand the value of the industry, which is correct, and that they are demanding these blue-collar workers pay the costs of transition for the broader community. And on current form, that's also correct. So to finish, Australia will have a coal industry for many decades to come. Coking coal exports are growing for now and will be here for the long term. Thermal coal exports are growing for now and will be here until our customers stop buying it based on their own decisions around energy and emissions. Not one other nation has cut back on its exports to reduce emissions in other countries. But domestic coal power is in decline, and operators have told us that power stations will certainly close in the years and decades ahead. Governments need do nothing. The current state of climate politics is back to front. By targeting the export sector instead of what we can do about emissions we produce here in Australia, green activists have alienated the maximum number of people for the least effect. Well done. When it comes to progressing climate action that is based on the science, based on agreed international frameworks and looks after workers, my advice is simple. Look at what's happened over the last few years and just do the opposite. And that means parking the attacks on export coal. The industry will face change in the future, but that will be driven by its customers. Holding the government to account for meeting Australia's domestic emissions reductions commitments across the whole economy. It's not just energy. More planning and less politics around future power station closures, with investment to support affected workers and communities. And rebuilding some consensus around climate politics, which is admittedly a much harder task than protesting and grandstanding and point scoring and fear-mongering. And finally, but most importantly, can someone please find some wheel locks for Bob Brown's car? Thank you.
Many thanks to Tony Marr for a lovely and important presentation tonight. So we come to questions and discussion. I'll be operating this area here, and Jacqueline will be operating down the back. Don't stand in front of the camera, and keep your comments or questions short. Important speech tonight. It's going to create a bit of interest, I would think. But if you took that speech to your colleagues in the... Well, if you took that speech to the coalition, I think you would get... For what you're saying about coal exports, you would get overwhelming support. Not unanimous, but overwhelming support. But if you took it to the... Forgetting the Greens, if you took it to the Labor Party, there would be some degree of opposition within the Labor Party, would there not? Not just in the Greens. So the problem stems, from your perspective, not just the Greens in the political sense, but to some extent the Labor Party. So how's the Labor Party fronting up on the issue of exporting of coal?
You're right about the federal government. They would welcome certain comments and other comments not so much. And... but I think that there's also a large part of at least the Liberal Party that would rather some consensus on climate and energy. They just don't have the numbers. In terms of the Labor Party, I don't think the Labor Party would have appointed Joel Fitzgibbon as Resources Shadow Minister if they didn't think that much of what I said is true. I think they have learned an important lesson from the last election. None of their policies, in my judgment, were going to necessarily lead to job losses, but they didn't advocate for the industry. They were silent. That was their main focus. And I think Joel's appointment fills a significant hole. I detect within the Labor Party a different sort of discussion.
So we're going to get here, then we're going to get there.
Thank you for the most interesting talk. With the huge amount of money coming in through coal exports, do you think the Greens have looked into the fact that who's going to pay their welfare payments in the inner city electorates if the coal industry goes out of business?
Yeah. Well, their current policy, I think, is to phase out all coal mining, including exports, by 2030. Now, that is an economy killer. I mean, even if you accept that sometime over this century it will all go, and I'm not entirely sure about that, then how do you fill that $60 billion hole? You've got to fill it with something, and you've got to fill it in a way that it doesn't all happen at once. So it's just a ridiculous bit of target fetishism by the Greens, with no practical reality about it at all. And they've been complicit with the environment groups in deluding people into thinking that because uneconomic coal industries in Europe that aren't a large part of their economy get phased out, that we should do the same. And it's just chalk and cheese.
Tony, just say where you are.
State Labor strongholds like Rockhampton, Mackay and Cessnock swung savagely against Federal Labor in May with swings of 15%. How can Labor win back workers in Claremont and Mount Morgan at the next election, either with policy or with what it talks about?
Well, that's a matter for Labor. I'm just a humble union official. They've got their job cut out for them. As I say, I don't think they're... I think their policies will change. I don't know what they'll be. But what they've got to be is vocally in support of the industry. They tried to be half pregnant on Adani, and it didn't work. You can't tell one story in the city and another story in the country. But I think the real killer is Bob Brown's self-righteous convoy into central Queensland. That galvanised them more than State of Origin. And that's saying something.
There's a question down the back. Yeah.
Given that the Greens seem to be the tail that wags the Labor dog, and Labor seems to have no trouble with that, isn't it perhaps time for the CFMEU and the energy sector in particular, whose jobs are absolutely dependent on coal that the Greens want to destroy, perhaps put your political muscle to another party?
Oh, look, we've flirted with that over the many decades, and we always reach a conclusion it's too hard. It's not a new idea. In terms of the Greens wagon, the Labor dog, well, I can tell you that one of the misapprehensions in the last election was that the preference deal that Labor does routinely with the Greens is not a deal of policy. It's a deal of votes. It's vote harvesting. If you've got a House of Reps seat and Labor or Liberal finish one or two, then every Green vote's a Labor vote. That's what the preference deal does. Same in the Senate. It's about leftover quotas in Senate positions. So it's easy to say that that's the Greens are dictating policy. It actually isn't the case, in my view. And experience.
Just
stay where
you are. 2 points very briefly. The first is you outline very clearly the financial advantages to Australia of selling coal. But you didn't mention anything about the costs. I can just say in the last week, look at all the fires we've had in New South Wales. Yep. How much did that cost, both in money and in personal terms? And the other point, if you don't mind, I'm going to be very arrogant, and I hope.
But as long as you're arrogant and brief.
I'll be arrogant and brief. I'm a quite well-known professor at the University of Cambridge, and I was the chairman of the European Committee that talked about carbon capture and storage and reported to the European Commission. I might just say, I'm sorry, it's not that brief.
No, I wanted to be brief, but I really did.
But an Australian being head of a European Commission, and I wrote to the Prime Minister 4 or 5 months ago suggesting that he might start a fund for scientific research to do something else, and that a relatively small amount of money might lead to a huge advantage to Australia. Alan Finkel, who I said...
Okay, we've got to wind up.
Fingers crossed, and I got no response from ScoMo whatsoever.
Do you mean on CCS?
Sorry?
Do you mean on CCS, carbon capture and storage?
I'm sorry.
Were you talking at the end there about carbon capture and storage?
I gave a number of examples, okay. Not only carbon capture.
Don't ask him, he'll answer.
Okay. All right, well, on the first question, yeah, there are costs to changing climate and bushfires, etc. are getting worse. That's why you do need international instruments to deal with it. So we weren't saying you don't do that. Do I have cost estimates on it? No. We don't have expertise in that. I'll leave that for others. In terms of having a discussion about whether it's adaptation or technologies to reduce emissions, that should be done. I don't know why there's not a lot more bipartisanship in this space. I mean, we tried to encourage governments to get involved in carbon capture and storage. It didn't receive sufficient support from industry or governments, but it's going to be necessary for our industrial manufacturing base, even if we've missed the boat on power stations. So we need to resurrect a discussion about that.
Lindsay.
As a humble union official, divorced from politics, your comments on reports that parts of the union movement will campaign against the Queensland state government in the next state election because of some of its policies.
These things happen from time to time from the constituent parts of the union. I have no idea what the issues are. I haven't read any reports. And we have 22 reporting units, and they all have a significant degree of autonomy. They don't ring me up for permission to take a stance. So that's the harsh reality.
Just before we go to the next question, you might just explain your division is against the other divisions in the large amalgamated union, because as you know, the construction union is the one that gets the most publicity.
Yeah.
But where do the others come in? I mean, do you operate as a general union, or do you operate specifically as a federated divisions?
Oh yeah, no, we're really a federation of four separate unions. Maritime Union, Maritime Division, are very autonomous. The Mining and Energy Division determine the union's policies on mining and energy and climate change. We determine our own bargaining strategy. We're completely independent. We do meet at the top level a few times a year and try and nut out things that we can do together. And we, I think, do some good things at that level. But, yeah, it's very autonomous. And that's the deliberate design of the organisation.
Given your sort of what you're saying kind of concurs with Scott Morrison and the Liberals' policies at the moment, how are your negotiations then going with the government? Do you have a good relationship with federal and state, or are there some issues there in saving jobs and exports and the Australian dollar?
Yeah, well, the miners have always tried to get on with the government of the day. So we have a good relationship with John Barilaro, who's got the industry responsibility in the New South Wales government. We used to get on well with Ian Corsley when he was the Mines Minister. In terms of the current federal government, it's been pretty hostile, frankly. And we're their favourite union to attack. But I've started to request meetings with key ministers, particularly in the energy and resources space, because I think the policy issues are far more important than political party issues.
Thanks, Tony. I'm glad I came tonight because of the clarity, I think, that you've given us in your presentation. But looking to the future, you talked about coking coal and thermal coal. But how distinctive is that division? I mean, is the potential coking coal able to expand so that eventually we might just be exporting coal for steel manufacture?
Oh, that might happen one day. And I'd defer to Bob Cameron on this, who's here somewhere, that there is an amount of thermal coal that's produced that can be produced as semi-soft coking coal. It's not so black and white, though it's all black.
So there really could be a strong long-term future for this industry
if
these climate issues
And resolve. And I think when I said the International Energy Agency says that our coal exports will grow through to 2040, that means peak at 2040. Any decline after that is a long way away. So you know, maybe thermal coal exports will peak earlier than that. It depends on what, you know, our biggest customer is Japan. Depends on what they do with their nuclear program, whether they kickstart those things again. And, you know, as an export industry, you're always in the hands of your customers. That bit's not new. And so we don't know when the peak is, but there's a long tail after the peak. Because a lot of our coal goes to markets in countries where, under the Paris Agreement, they're allowed to have their emissions rise for much longer. It's only developed countries under that deal that have to tap the brakes hard, right? That's why, you know, European countries are phasing out their coal, apart from the fact that they're very uneconomic and a small part of their economy. But we're selling to growing markets. Now, you know, we're in the lap of the gods about that.
Question down the back.
Thank you. Thanks, Tony, for a fantastic talk. I'm just curious that as we transition eventually away from thermal coal, how is the industry looking toward a transition towards mining other minerals, such as lithium, nickel, rare earth minerals, that may be a bigger part of the renewable economy, and also where you see hydrogen sitting in this?
Oh, well, we're mining all those things now, so we don't have to pivot to it. It's already happening. In fact, that conference that I made a joke about earlier on, I think it might have had one session out of 50 about coal. The rest was about lithium and everything, all the ingredients of an electric car. Those things are happening anyway. In terms of transition, you've got to bear in mind that mineral deposits are where the mineral deposits are, not necessarily where the workforces are or the communities are that you want to look after. So it's going to be a struggle, but as the German example shows, you can manage change if you get a long period of time and you get some commitment and cooperation and investment.
Yeah.
You mentioned AGL and you also mentioned activist investors and some of the effect that they've had. You were talking about how the effect they've had is far greater than they deserve. We find that a lot of boards are being pressured by investment analysts who are on the receiving end of those investors. What do you do to help them combat some of that misinformation?
Well, it's probably not a lot I can do, apart from give the odd speech at the Sydney Institute. Investors, I think a lot of investment activists take the easy path. That of the whole ESG space, the easy path is divest away from fossil fuels and ignore bad labour practices, wage theft, and a whole host of other communal bads. My complaint is that the effort is going into one space a serious ESG approach by investors would be looking at the whole program. And I do worry that investors agitating for a low emissions future aren't paying attention to what happens to the workforce and how to spread the cost. You know, for people in the cities, restructuring your electricity system won't change their daily lives. Go out in the regions and it changes their everything. You know, as long as prices don't go up, it doesn't change their lives. Lights still come on. That's why you've got to balance the cost across the community.
We're just going to camp around there. Just before, the mining industry talks a lot about the number of Indigenous Australians employed in the industry, so I guess you've got quite a few members in your union, do you? Mm. In the remote areas of Australia? I mean, what's the union interaction with the Indigenous workers?
Many of them join, some of them don't, and that's just like anybody. We've employed a national Indigenous officer who's got a dialogue with the major companies who have their own, you know, executive team responsible for this area. Anything to encourage Indigenous employment is to be encouraged. Because apart from anything, there are people in the local area who want to live in the local area and are available to work. And, of course, they should be encouraged. So we support the company's efforts in that regard.
There's a question here.
Tony, talking about the coal industry and the Adani affair, whatever it was, there was a huge dispute about how many jobs it would create and how many jobs it wouldn't create, whatever. And I think a lot of people are confused about what the jobs are in the coal industry, so you could explain that to us a bit more. But as in all industry, increasing technology is changing jobs, and driverless trucks and all that sort of thing are coming into the coal mining industry. So how do you see jobs changing in the future, and do you see the ability of coal mining to keep up with the employment of people being sustained?
Yeah, I think Adani got attacked as being, you know, it's going to introduce 100% automation and there won't be any jobs, and anybody who's happy for it to go ahead is a fool. I understand that it's a 10 million tonne mine. There are many of those. They employ about 1,500 workers on conventional mining methods. That's what Lucas Dow of Adani tells me he's going to do. They're not doing any automation. I mean, this is their first foray into Australian mining. They're not going to do what Rio Tinto did in iron ore and invest $1 billion over a decade to do autonomous haulage. They just want to mine stuff for a number of years and get it over to India. So I think a lot of that propaganda around them is wrong. On the general point about automation, we expect that, and again, we have some dialogue with companies at a senior level about this. For them, it's a social license to operate issue at the very senior level, not the site people, but at the very senior level. Because if regions don't get jobs and governments don't get royalties in similar proportion to what they get now, well, why allow the mining? We expect that they will be wanting to introduce an amount of autonomous operations and remote operations. We think it might affect about 30% of the workforce, but Australian mining as a whole is 250,000. So that still leaves a big employment pool. If we can get through that again with no forced redundancies and some retraining, then that's really the objective. Because you won't stop change, but there's no off-the-shelf trucks. The technology is all proprietary. Developed by the big mining companies for a very high cost. So, you know, no mid-sized company is going to be able to do it. You know, eventually that will happen. So I think it's still got a fair way to roll out, even though it gets a lot of press.
We're getting close to the end. If I've missed anyone, let us know. So we go there, we go here, yeah.
At the top level of the union, you feed into the Labor National Conference, which writes policy. And the current policy is to severely restrict uranium mining. Does your union distinguish uranium from any other thing you dig out of the ground? Do you have a view on the Labor Party policy on uranium mining?
I haven't given consideration to the uranium mining issue for a long time. That's really the province of another union, the AWU, and they're quite supportive of uranium mining. And it would be hypocritical for me to try and oppose mining of one commodity and not the other, you know.
Michael.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for the plug for the ad at the end.
We're very close to these days.
You've talked about the the political pressures and others from the Greens, particularly on coal mining. But there are a few others. At the moment, there is a significant sort of debate going on about longwall mining and its impact upon the water supply, particularly down the Illawarra. And also, of course, over the years, there's been pushback from the great growers, the wine industry, and the Hunter, and whether it's mining or gas and so on. So, just if you've got a comment about those other pressures that come at you, not from phase out coal because of climate change, but because of the industries co-location, if you like, with other agricultural industries particularly.
Yes, yes. This is a big issue in New South Wales, not so much Queensland. Queensland, it's quite a kind of cattle country in the middle of nowhere. But in New South Wales, you've got competing land use issues, particularly in the Hunter Valley. You've got urban encroachment in the Illawarra district. So they are things that just have to be managed in a objective and transparent way. There will be some mines or extensions of mines that are not permitted to go ahead. Our view is that it shouldn't be the loudest voice that determines that. It should be a transparent process based on engineering and science and all that sort of stuff that people tell us we have to listen to in other areas. And competing land use, that's a difficult one. You know, horse studs versus coal mining and competing claims. You always have that when you've got an extractive industry. I mean, theoretically, mining's meant to be a temporary phenomenon, and the land returned to other uses. But it's not seen that way because it's been around for a long time and it keeps growing. And the reason you've got problems in the Hunter Valley is that it keeps growing up the valley, up the Scone and beyond. But in the Illawarra, it's the rivers and creeks and catchments and dams. But all we'd say is that we'll determine it based on engineering reports and science.
So finally, coming to the end of the year, for next year, the aim of what are the sort of priorities of the union as you move into sort of the first year of the return coalition government?
Well, we'll be trying to engage with the government in a sensible way on energy and resources policy, we hope that's reciprocated. I actually do have a meeting with Matt Canavan lined up. I'd make the point that that's not the first time in history. I mean, it has happened many times in the past. And we need to deal with whoever's the government of the day. So we'll be doing that. We'll have some challenges with the Ensuring Integrity Bill that looks like it might get through pretty soon. So that's a challenge for every union, probably most especially ours. So we'll do whatever we can with that. It sort of depends on the government, what challenges it throws up to us. The Act's just available to be used. We'll see how they use it.
Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.